Welcome to The Journey, a chronological study which goes through scripture from Genesis to Revelation in chronological order.
It's interesting, there's a series of stories here together, and one of them in particular is a pretty peculiar story in some ways. I'm interested in what you guys think, but I did notice, I think as we often do as we go through this chronologically, that this peculiar story makes more sense, again, in context, when it's not just a separate story. But so I'm going to give you a heads up. I think we're about to go through a bunch of stories which actually started last week. So where we left off last week was that Jesus has been pushing the envelope, and he's been challenging them. First of all, the challenge we were seeing over the last couple times we met was that he was trying to help them understand that Gentiles shouldn't be regarded as unclean, that they are going to be made clean by Jesus just like the Israelites are, and that that's the inside that needs to change, and not cling so much to the traditions that they lose sight of what God's really doing. And so he was beginning to push the envelope on that, make everybody from his disciples, from his apostles to his disciples as a whole, to the Pharisees, everybody a little uncomfortable. And then he begins to start, as the disciples begin to really settle into the fact that he is the Messiah, he begins to really push and challenge their notion of what the Messiah is. And specifically, he begins to be really clear about the fact that he's going to die. So clear that Peter begins to really resist that. Resist is not even strong enough a word. He begins to oppose that. He says, that can't be right. Jesus, you've got this wrong. And so that's kind of where we were. And what's interesting is we begin to see this conflict that Jesus both promotes, I think, this tension, as well as tries to help them move through this, that the disciples are experiencing. And so as always, as we look at some of these stories, remember that a lot of them, well, all of them are being done with Jesus being aware that his apostles are there. And I think many of them are done the way they're done in order to teach the apostles a lesson. Kind of like the story we looked at a couple of weeks ago with the Gentile woman, where he engaged with her in a certain kind of debate for the benefit of the apostles, so they could see her win that debate and understand the value and the honor he was giving her. And we have some other stories, I think, that are like that today, where some of it is because he knows what the disciples are wrestling with. And so he's trying to really teach them some really important things before he goes. And I'm going to go ahead and give you kind of the rough view of what I think the stories that we're about to read are saying. I think what we're seeing is the tension between the apostles' understanding of glory and power and Jesus' understanding of glory and power, and how his death, for example, can be glory and power when to them it looks like defeat. And so we see that tension that they keep kind of going back and forth. They keep going to one side of what glory and power is, and he keeps pulling them back and saying, is that really glory and power? Because if it is, that's not what I'm doing. You need to look at things differently. You need to stop looking at things from a perspective of what will glorify you and what makes you look good to other people. You need to recognize real glory and power comes in humility, comes in different ways. So I think we see that kind of through these stories. And I think it actually starts with him assuring them that he's going to die. So it kind of started there. He's trying to help them see, my ministry is to die. That's weird. That's strange. That looks like defeat. It doesn't look like power. It doesn't look like glory. It doesn't look like victory, but it is. There's power in that. And we talked a little bit about that 2 weeks ago. So right on the heels of that, where he's been telling them that he's going to die and suffer, and that's somehow where the power of God will be seen, where the power of the kingdom of God will be seen, is what he said to them. You will not pass away before you see the power of God come. And he meant in his death and his resurrection. So right on the heels of that, they're still wrestling with that. They're still reeling from the idea that he's trying to, they're telling themselves he's being metaphorical. They don't really understand him, but they still don't like what he's saying. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't match their pictures of glory and power. Right on the heels of him challenging that, he takes Peter, James, and John with him, and they have an experience which is much more akin to what they do like. And so that's the story we're going to look at next. And it's kind of setting up this conflict of, you know, the kind of power they do like, the kind of glory they do like, the kind of picture of Jesus they want to hold on to, and then recognizing that Jesus is that, but he's also this other side of suffering and death that they don't want to see. And here's my wife joining us. Okay, so we're starting at Mark 9, verses 2 through 13. And this is, again, this is the more traditional view for them. This is what they would think glory and power would look like. And it's an amazing picture. And, you know, it's interesting. Jesus only takes three of his apostles with him. Maybe he thought only three of them could even begin to handle the conflict, that, or maybe these three more specifically needed the tension. I don't know, but he takes, or maybe it's just he enjoys being with these three humanly. I don't know what the situation is, but he just takes these three. It says, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. And there he was transfigured before them. The word transfigured, this appears only a couple of times in scripture. And it's the only time in our English translations that we translate it transfigured. And it's kind of a word, transfigured, is kind of a word that only applies to this moment, because we don't know quite how else to describe what happens. So let me read what happens, and then we'll talk about this word transfigured, because it is interesting, the one other place it shows up in the New Testament. So he says, there he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before him Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. So what happens is he goes up on this mountain with them, and he changes, right? The word transfigured means it's transformed. The literal word is metamorphosed. It's the same word we get the Greek word metamorphosed from. But what's interesting is what's clearly happening here is not that Jesus is becoming something that he's never been before. What's happening is that he's revealing who he's always been. So he's been God. He's been the Son of God. He's been the Messiah. He's been divine the whole time he's been on earth. But as this is the first moment he's really revealing it to anybody on this earth. And so he takes Peter and James and John. They go up on the mountain. They're all alone. And while they're there, he suddenly begins to radiate just incredibly bright white glow. You know, he begins to glow. It. I think the description here is echoing when it says that Moses wanted to see God, and God said, you can't handle seeing me, but I'll let you just catch a glimpse of me as I pass by. And it describes there that it shined. It shone and shined, you know, really bright. And that when Moses came down from the mountain after spending time with God, even like that, his face would shine really brightly, like he just carried some of it. So I think that's kind of the picture, just this glory is so bright. What's interesting about the word transfigured here, later it's used of us and says that we should be transformed. Romans 12, we'll see it later. It says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And even there, it's clear that it doesn't mean that we're to become something we're not. It's that we're supposed to reveal who God has made us already. And so that's what the word transfigured means, that they go up on the mountain and God is removing a mask. The word literally means to remove a mask. It's the opposite of masquerade in the Greek language. So when you masquerade, you put on a mask. When you're transfigured or transformed, you take off the mask. So it's like Jesus has been wearing this mask of mortality and humanity this whole time. And for just this brief moment, Peter and James and John get to see him, who he actually is. And this story is so large, I think it's easy for us to not realize how large it is. This is like fainting level strange. I mean, Peter, James, and John must just be beside themselves, just out of their minds with what's happening. Because not only is Jesus glowing just crazy bright, but then Elijah and Moses actually appear and they are having a conversation with Jesus. And my first question is, how do they know it's Elijah and Moses? Is it because he calls them by name? It's not like they had any better picture of what they actually looked like than we do, I suspect. But somehow they know, or I assume they know. I guess it doesn't actually, well, it does say they know later. Somehow they know, but just picture this amazing moment. Just for a moment, kind of try to recognize Peter, James, and John have just been very depressed about this whole dying thing that Jesus is telling them. Now they go up in a mountain, and this is more like it. This is crazy. This is power. This is glory. This is everything they wanted him to do. Finally, he's kind of casting off all of this stuff, you know, particularly they probably thought the dying stuff. He's finally kind of casting it off and he's showing them who he actually is. And there right in front of them are Elijah and Moses. I do want to point out too, because I think it's relevant for Peter and James and John, Elijah and Moses aren't just two sort of randomly picked people from the Old Testament. They are the representatives of the two parts of the Old Testament, what we call the law and the prophets. Moses represents the law, Elijah represents the prophets. So what we have here is this picture for them that Jesus is here to fulfill everything that the law told us and everything that the prophets told us. And it's like the law, the prophets, and Jesus are having this consultation because it's finally going to happen, whatever it is. But again, for Peter, James, and John, you can imagine that this does not seem like a precursor to Jesus dying. This seems like a precursor to Jesus coming down off the mountain, taking control of the world, vanquishing the Romans. Again, in their mind, this is what they've been waiting for. All that dying talk, they knew it was just a metaphor and probably just meant this was going to happen. He was going to change. I mean, I just imagine that's where their brains are going. And I think you kind of see that in Peter's reaction. So it says, Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. So fair enough. Peter is just rambling a little bit, because this is crazy, this is weird. But I want you to notice even the nature of his rambling. He's just afraid, so he's just talking, because that's what Peter does when he's nervous. I get the idea Peter's that guy. When he's nervous, when he's afraid, when he's angry, almost whatever his emotion is, talking is what happens. And so he's just kind of rambling, but the nature of his rambling is interesting, because they, again, when they were down off of the mountain, things were not great, right? Jesus kept talking about dying. He kept talking about suffering. Now they're on the mountain and it looks like it's supposed to look. And what does Peter want to do? He wants to set up shop here. He wants to make it home here. He wants to build shelters for Moses, Elijah, and Jesus because he doesn't want to go back down the mountain. He wants to stay here and he wants them to stay here. This is the moment. This is what he's been waiting for. We don't have to leave this place, Jesus. We can stay here. So I think even in his reaction, there's a little bit of his resistance to the idea of glory that Jesus has been trying to give him. It's like Peter is saying, I don't like that death glory. That one I want to move on from. I like this transfiguration glory. This, let's camp here, literally. Let's stay here. We'll build shelters for you. So that's not going to happen quickly. And once you build shelters, you're staying. So that's clearly in Peter's mind. This is where we want to be. This is where I want to be. Let's stick around here and not leave it. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. I kind of love that too, because Peter's talking and rambling, and God's like, shh, hush, hush. You should listen to my son. And the interesting thing is, what has Jesus been saying? He's been saying, I'm going to die. So as much as Peter doesn't like it, what God is affirming here is Jesus is telling you what he's going to do, and he's doing it as my son. He's doing it as God, and he's going to die, and that's what this is about, and that's what the plan is about. And Elijah and Moses get it. Peter, you want to stay here, but instead you should listen to Jesus. So suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. So it's kind of like God, Elijah, Moses, they've all confirmed and affirmed who Jesus is in a really big and huge way for Peter, James, and John. And now what Peter, James, and John have to wrestle with is, so what does that mean about him dying? We're supposed to listen to that? We're supposed to trust that? How can that even jive with this picture of glory that we've just seen from the mountain? So to kind of drive that point home, here's what it says. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant, which just makes me laugh, because turns out, I understand why they're discussing that, because that's just crazy talk. But it turns out what he meant by rising from the dead was rising from the dead. And they're spending all this time trying to figure out what's the metaphor, what's the symbolism. Maybe this transfiguration was rising from the dead. Maybe that's all he meant. You know, he can't actually die, so he can't actually rise from the dead. But, you know, they're just trying to discuss it all. And he's now telling them, I am, on the way down the mountain, he's giving them both sides. I am going to die. I will raise from the dead. What you've just seen should make you believe anything I tell you is possible at this point. But instead of saying, maybe what he keeps telling us straightforward over the last several chapters is literally what's going to happen. Instead of that, they're like, I wonder what this means. What could he mean by this? Wonder what this means. So they're having all this discussion. And they asked him, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? I think they're asking this question because they've just seen Elijah. So we've heard this story a little bit, that the tradition, the understanding, based on some prophecies, which could be read different ways, but their understanding traditionally by some people was that literally Elijah would come and say, the Messiah is coming. And what we saw with John the Baptist was that John the Baptist said, I'm not Elijah, I'm not literally Elijah. But Jesus confirmed that John came in the spirit or the role of Elijah. So in one sense, the prophecy was that John the Baptist would be an Elijah-type person who would say, prepare the way of the Lord. So that has happened already. But now they see Elijah literally here. And so it's also true that apparently before Jesus fulfills his ministry, Elijah does come in a very literal way. But now, understandably, they're asking about it. Is this what we were supposed to see? You know, what does this mean? They're just trying to process it. And Jesus replied, to be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. If you want to ask me what that means, I will tell you, I don't really know. I really don't 100% understand that line. He says, why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him. So I don't understand the first line, but the rest of it appears to me what Jesus is saying is this. They're saying, doesn't Elijah have to come first? And Jesus is sort of saying yes, but then he's redirecting them back to the thing they're avoiding, the question they really don't get. He's redirecting them back to, look, I know you want to talk about Elijah. You want to talk about the glory of Elijah. You want to talk about the glory of the Messiah. Don't forget, the Son of Man has to suffer and be rejected. That is still happening. And I understand you're asking, why does that have to happen, right? Why is that even necessary? But then he goes on, and then I think he is talking about John the Baptist. When he says Elijah has come, they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him. Now, this whole passage is a little mysterious, so it's possible I'm wrong, but that's how I understand it. I think he's saying to them, it has happened. John did come. They did execute him. They did all everything they wanted to do, just as it was predicted. And guess what? Just as John the Baptist suffered and died, so Jesus is going to suffer and be rejected and die. And you may wonder, how does that idea of suffering fit with the glory of Elijah coming? You've just seen Elijah with me. Now you're going to see me suffer and be rejected. And you're going to ask yourself, if Jesus could do this on this mountaintop, what we saw there was something that means Jesus could never be defeated by anybody. How does that reconcile with what we're going to see of the Son of Man suffering and being rejected? And I think he's posing for them that tension. He's saying, I know this is the tension you're wrestling with. And then I think reminding them that John the Baptist himself died and suffered at the hands of men. So I think that's the thrust of the story. Let me go ahead and read it. It comes up in the other two passages, and then I'll open it up for whatever thoughts you guys have about all this. So Matthew 17, 1 through 13, same story, says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And while he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down on the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. And the disciples asked him, why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And Jesus replied, to be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things. But I tell you, Elijah has already come. And they did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. So things that I sort of speculated, I now realize I speculated because I read it in Matthew. So I feel better about my speculation that he actually tells them he's talking about John the Baptist. And he makes that connection clear that in the same way John the Baptist suffered, so also the Son of Man will suffer. Okay, Luke 9:28, let's read the story again. About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. 2 men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. So here we find out, interestingly, they are talking about his death. They're talking about the fact he's going to die and come back to life. So again, I don't know how much the Peter, James, John are understanding or hearing or listening to, but it's interesting they're actually discussing that. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the 2 men standing with him. By the way, if it makes you feel better, Peter, James, and John, in at least 3 occasions in the Gospels, tend to fall asleep whenever Jesus is praying. So if you've ever had that situation, you can know that even the heavy hitters had that same situation. All right. Were sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and covered them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone, and the disciples kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone at that time what they had seen. We know from the other Gospels it's because Jesus said not to. It would have been hard to keep that secret, but Jesus said don't, and apparently they honored that until after Jesus had come back to life. All right, anybody have any comments or thoughts on this really amazing story that's in all the Gospels except for John? Does anybody have any comments or thoughts on these stories, this story?
I do find it interesting, of all the stories John left out, it was this one.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Pam? Do you have an idea why that is?
I don't, but it's just always astounded me that, you know, he didn't say anything about it.
It's true. It's a big story. One possibility is that John does seem actually to be there's two things that do seem, I mean, there's a lot of things, but there's two things in particular that do drive a lot of the stories he leaves out and puts in. One is he seems to be very careful about exalting himself. So I think one of the three, only three people who saw this story, I think he kind of is reluctant to kind of paint that picture. The second is he also seems to be interested in mostly telling stories that haven't already been told. Knowing that John is the last gospel, he can look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke and say, well, they all told this story. I don't need to tell it again. People know this story. So I think there's some of that, is it? Plus, he just has a whole different approach. He's coming at it from a different perspective. It's even possible, because he's writing to Greeks and to Gentiles and Jews and Romans and Greeks, he's kind of covering the gamut. It's possible he was worried this would confuse maybe Romans and Greeks, even about Son of Man, Son of God. I don't know. It does seem like it would be a hard story not to tell. So I kind of agree with you, Pam. But I do think he's trying to remain very modest. I think he is genuinely humble, but I think he's trying not to involve himself. And it is a story that's been told three times. So he's kind of like, yeah, I don't need to tell this one again. And he doesn't repeat a lot of what Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell, with the exception, of course, of the crucifixion and the resurrection themselves, which is the point of all of their stories. So they all have that. Any other
thoughts? Well, I guess that's true.
Yeah. Any other thoughts?
Well, I was just thinking about how, you know, he asked him before, like, who do you say I am? And other people were saying he was like, I mean, I guess some were saying Elijah, but then some were saying like John the Baptist, which I guess is kind of Elijah in spirit, but, and like Jeremiah. But I think that it probably drove home the point more, like having like Moses and Elijah there with him. And so they're like, well, we know he can't die. And I guess we know he's not those people because we see them, but now it really doesn't work or make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's
but it would be a very like powerful, like connecting, like huge thing for them, you know, at this point, kind of 100%. Connecting the dots.
100%. And that's why I say it'd be a hard story not to share, because even not even to glorify yourself, although let's be honest, that would be a temptation. You know, oh, you'll never believe what I saw. But even past the selfish aspect of it, it's such an amazing thing. You would want to tell your friends. You'd be like, guess what? Jesus just had a conversation with Moses and Elijah, and I think he might be God, or he's at least something. God said he was his son. I mean, it would be really hard not to let everybody else in on that story. So Jesus must have really impressed them with, you don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody till after I've come back to life. So yeah, pretty incredible. So the next.
Well, in some ways.
Oh, go right ahead.
I was just going to say, in some ways too, it's like, like they've heard the words and stuff about it, but now they're like really like kind of like seeing it, and it's.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. This was a demonstration of power and glory, which is just huge. So Any other thoughts? So here's what's interesting. The next story is a story that is peculiar for a couple of reasons, but it's fascinating to me that in all three of the Gospels that we just read tell this story, all three of them connect it to coming down the mountain. So there's no question about the chronology here that they want us to see, that he's coming off of the Mount of Transfiguration and this next story happens right away, which means that Peter, James, and John are actually not part of what has been happening. It's like they come down and the rest of the apostles are having this interaction. Something else is going on while they've been on the mountain. And I think coming down from the mountain with, and think where Peter's at, he doesn't want to come down from the mountain. He wants to continue to build the shelters. He wants to stay there. This, everything's good up there. When we come back to earth, so to speak, we're back to suffering and death. Even on the way down the mountain, Jesus has to bring up dying again. It's just like, what a letdown, what a bummer. So there is this tension that the writers of the Gospels are bringing up. They were on the mountain, glory and power as they expected it to be. Jesus keeps bringing them back down, though, from the mountain to remind them that glory and power is going to involve his death and his suffering. And I think that this story is going to tell us about the struggle that the apostles are having with wanting to themselves be part of a glory which doesn't involve suffering and dying. I think this story makes more sense if we kind of see it from that aspect. And Mark adds something to this story that or tells us a detail in this story that the other gospel writers don't tell us. And I actually think, for me, it helps. I think it gives me at least a foothold of what might be going on. So I'll tell you how I read it, and you can disagree because some of this absolutely is not 100% clear in the text. But it fits the context and it fits what Jesus says and why he says it. So let me walk through this first version of it, kind of share with you how I think it flows contextually, and then we'll read the other stories, then you guys can kind of see what you think too. It says, when they came to the other disciples, the later versions actually say, when they came down from the mountain. So this is Peter, James, and John, and Jesus, and they're coming down the mountain. They've just had this incredible experience, and here's what they are greeted by when they come down. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them, and the teachers of the law were arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. Now, overwhelmed with wonder could mean he's still shining a little bit like Moses did, but it doesn't have to, because he is still a very popular figure at this moment. People are already overwhelmed with wonder that he does miracles. So I don't know which it means, but here's the scenario. They come down the mountains, and the disciples, the other apostles, not Peter, James, and John, but the others, and maybe some of just the general disciples who are in the crowd. So, you know, maybe Mary and Martha and just some of the other disciples, they're arguing with the teachers of the law. There's some squabble going on. There's some argument going on. And what's interesting is, if you don't read this carefully, Jesus asks them what they're arguing about, and the answer they give doesn't appear to relate to his question, but I think it has to. That's the only way. I mean, I don't think they're completely ignoring his question. I think they are telling him, this is what we're arguing about, but it's not immediately clear why or how. And I think that's where part of the key is. So let me read it, and then I'll explain what I mean. It says, as soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. What are you arguing with them about? He asked. So to his disciples, what are you arguing with the teachers of the law about? What's going on? A man in the crowd answered. So this is the answer to Jesus's question. Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. You unbelieving generation, Jesus replied. How long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered, it has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, said Jesus, everything is possible for one who believes. Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. And after Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? And he replied, this kind can only come out by prayer. All right. This is an odd story. And for a story that is not, to my mind, super clear, there's a lot of theology drawn from it. So, you know, there are sort of exorcist experts who draw all sorts of things here about some spirits that need prayer and some that don't. I think that's not the point of the story. In fact, I think you could argue all spirits need prayer. But what is happening here? And a couple of things that stand out are that strange thing at the end where the disciples couldn't drive out this one, even though they've done others, they've been given authority. The ire, you know, we talk about sometimes how things depend on the tone with which you read them, but there is, for me, it's very hard to find a tone which isn't a little bit irritated at the beginning here from Jesus, right? I mean, he says literally, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? He's frustrated to whatever degree God can be frustrated, whatever that means. But there's a human ire here. There's something here that is really bothering him in a way that he's not always bothered. You know, people ask him for help. He doesn't usually say, oh, why don't you believe? Why are you unbelieving? Why do I have to put up with you? I'm so ready to be gone. He doesn't usually respond that way. So that kind of stands out. So we've got all these things that are happening. The disciples are not able to cast out the spirits. Jesus seems to react very strongly to them, like they're unbelieving. But then after accusing them of being unbelieving, he says anything is possible for the one who believes, which should mean the apostles should have been able to do it. But then he tells them, no, it needs prayer. So what is that about? And then the Father says, I do believe, help me overcome my unbelief, which in itself is it's an understandable conflict in him. What he's really saying is, I want to believe, but I don't. I need you to help me. But if he's saying I don't, and then Jesus heals him, that also doesn't fit with what Jesus just said, that it's all about belief. So he seems upset they don't believe, but he's not upset this guy doesn't believe. But then it turns out it wasn't just belief, it was prayer. All of this is kind of a hodgepodge of what is happening. And here's the way that it makes sense to me, and I'll share it. And then I'm interested, you guys are totally welcome to disagree, or maybe you have even better thoughts here. But here's how it all flows in my head. It all comes back to what they're arguing about. Jesus says, what are you arguing with them about? And the answer is, well, there's this spirit that's in my son and the apostles weren't able to drive him out. I think that's what they're arguing about, is that the disciples failed. The disciples tried to cast out this spirit. They failed and the teachers of the law jumped on that, right? You can imagine they would. They're like, oh, you're not so great. You're not so powerful. And it turns into this argument and this squabble. And I think the nature of this argument is not a pleasant one. It's not a theological one. And it's not one which makes the apostles look good or the teachers of the law. Because I think what happens is they're now arguing about who's more powerful, right? Who's stronger? Who's better? Who's more righteous? I think that's the nature of the argument, that the apostles are forced to try to defend themselves, to say, we have authority. We've cast out demons before. And the fair teachers are like, well, la-di-da, you didn't cast this one out. And maybe it even started because the apostles were showing off a little bit. I have no idea. That's even more speculative. I don't know that that's necessary for this argument. But I think that's the nature of the argument, that it's a self-preservation argument. It's a pride argument. It's the Pharisees trying to say they're better, they're more righteous, and here's the proof that the apostles failed. And the apostles are trying to defend themselves and saying, look, we know we can do this. We've done it before. We have this authority. Which I think shows, by the way, that they did believe they could do it. And we'll get to how that fits in with Jesus' statements later. I think they believed they could do it, but they couldn't do it. And now the Pharisees are all over them. They're arguing about it. I think Jesus hears the nature of the argument. He sees that his apostles are arguing from a place of pride and self-defense. And I think that's what he's irritated about. I think that's the unbelieving thing he's talking about, is that the apostles, it's not that they couldn't heal this guy's son, because at the end, he doesn't say, you didn't believe enough. He says, it needs prayer, which we'll talk about in a second. I think he's irritated that their picture of glory is confused. They think glory at this moment is having this incredible power that they become enamored with ever since he sent them out. And they came back and they were like, wow, demons went out in our name. And he even then warned them, hey, be careful. That's not the most important thing. But they're enamored with that. And so they're excited about that. They weren't able to do it. Now they're feeling defeated and defensive. And now Jesus is like, oh my gosh, that's not what this has all been about. I keep telling you, I'm going to suffer and die. It's not all about your ability to do magic tricks. It's not all about your ability to be powerful. I think that's what he's frustrated about. Not only the disciples, but the Pharisees, everybody. Everybody in that crowd is thinking wrongly. They're not believing what's really, they're not. And one thing you'll notice is they're not even, the kid is no longer even in their minds. The kid is no longer the thing. It's all about, can we cast out the spirit instead of this poor boy? And so when the man answers, he rightly brings it back to the boy. He's like, well, what they're arguing about is my boy, but the bottom line is I need help. I need help. And so that's what he says. And what's interesting to me is after Jesus' ire, his very next statement is after he says, you know, you're unbelieving and how long shall I stay with you? And he's kind of irritated. Then he says, bring the boy to me. His next statement, it strikes me again as very compassionate and rightly focused. Everyone is arguing about why the spirit couldn't be cast out and who's better and who's more important and who's more powerful and who's more glorious. And Jesus is like, well, how long has the boy been like this? Jesus is, I don't think he needs that for medical diagnosis. I think he's focused on the boy. He's like, well, this is terrible. This boy is having a time. How long has this been happening? And the father says, forever. And it's worse than it looks because he keeps trying to kill him. He ends up almost drowning and he ends up being burned. And then the man says, if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And to be fair to the man, he's already watched people who said they could heal his son fail. So I think that's part of the reason he's not so sure. He brought his son to Jesus. Jesus was busy on the mountain. So the disciples are like, we can do this. They fail. Then Jesus comes down. Now the man's like, well, maybe nobody can. But if you can, take pity on us and help us. And Jesus is like, if you can, of course I can. I mean, Jesus does rightly correct him that I can do it. What's fascinating to me is this next statement. And I think this has to be understood in a way that lines up with the statement at the end that it requires prayer for this one. And here's how I think it unfolds. He says, everything is possible for one who believes. And the boy's father immediately says, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. Okay, I think this is a very human and parental response. He says, first, I do believe, because he wants him healed. He's like, if that's what it takes, I believe. I believe. You're telling me I have to believe? I do believe. But immediately upon that, he's like, in honesty too, he's like, well, I don't really know though. I don't actually know, Jesus. I don't know if you can do this. Your disciples couldn't do it. Help me in my unbelief. And Jesus, notice what happens. Jesus immediately heals the boy. He doesn't say, well, sorry, you don't believe enough, which again would be, I think, the wrong theology to draw from this story. He doesn't say to the man, I told you everything can be done by one who believes, but you just told me you don't believe. You said, help me in my unbelief. That shows you don't believe. You know, I'm not going to help you. No, immediately as the guy says, help me in my unbelief, Jesus heals the boy. By the way, just a quick side note, the fact that the boy is mute and deaf was in the tradition of Jesus' time was supposed to make it harder for him to be exorcised because they believed you had to be able to name the spirit in order to cast it out. And if the boy, and remember when Jesus asked Legion, who are you? And it said, I'm Legion. And then Jesus cast him out. That was sort of the traditional view. Here, notice Jesus doesn't need a name. He doesn't need to ask who the name is. He doesn't need any of that. He just casts the spirit out. And he says, never, never come back. And he does, and then Jesus lifts him up. Now, then we come to the point where it says, after Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately. This leads credence to the fact that this was an argument and that they were defensive about. They don't want to ask Jesus in front of everyone else, why couldn't we do it? They don't want to acknowledge their failure. But with Jesus privately, they're willing to say, what happened? We tried. We were able to do it before, but this time we weren't. And he replied, this kind come out only by prayer. Now, here's how I think this all ties together. When Jesus says you're an unbelieving generation, and he says anything is possible for one who believes, and we're going to see this, I think, confirmed in one of the later gospels, but I'll try to make it clear here. When he says anything can be done by one who believes, and then the guy says, help me in my unbelief, and he heals him. And then he says to the disciples, your problem is you needed to pray. I think what he's saying is this. They believed, they had conviction. They had a sort of arrogant supposition that they could cast the demon out. They thought they were experts at this point, and they thought they could do it. Jesus isn't saying you need to have more conviction. You need to have stronger willpower. You need to be more convinced in your own ability. In fact, I think he's saying the opposite. I think he's saying you need to be, he's looking for a belief which is dependent. He's looking for a belief which is trusting in God, not in our own faith or our own abilities or our own willpower. And so when the man says, I do believe, help me in my unbelief, ironically, the father is showing the exact kind of faith Jesus is calling for, a faith which says, I can't do it. I can't believe hard enough to make it happen. I can't make this. I can't do anything. Help me. I'm just asking you to help me. I'm even asking you to help me believe enough for this to happen, if that's what has to happen. So he's showing by his dependence, by his asking God for help, in other words, by his prayer, right? That is a prayer. Help me in my unbelief. The guy doesn't know it's a prayer because he doesn't know Jesus is God, but it is a prayer. And he's saying, help me in my unbelief. That's the faith Jesus is looking for, is a dependent faith. So when the apostles say, why couldn't we drive it out? We believed, we were confident we could do it. Jesus looks at them and he says, yeah, that's not the kind of faith I'm talking about. You needed to have faith that I could do it, that God could do it. This kind only comes out by prayer, because prayer is not glorious to you. Prayer is not you standing up and showing your power. Prayer is you showing your weakness, your dependence, your vulnerability, your humility. It's you saying, we can't do it, and we need Jesus to do it. And I think that's the whole point of this story, is there's still this confusion about glory. And when he comes down from the mountain, they're all arguing the Pharisees how great they are. And Jesus is trying to help them understand, you couldn't cast this demon out because you're too worried about how great you are, because you think it's you doing it. This has to be done by God. And that means you request, you submit, you supplicate, and you submit yourself to God, as the Father did. When he said, help me in my unbelief, that's when he showed the faith that you needed to have to be able to make this demon go out. It needs to be a trust in God, not a trust in me. So even that statement, you unbelieving and perverse generation, he's not saying to them, you don't believe hard enough to be able to cast out demons. How shameful of you. He's saying, here you are arguing about how great you are instead of thinking about how great God is. And that shows your unbelief. Let me read the other two versions, because I think they'll actually confirm some of what I said by some of the details they throw in. But then I'm interested in your thoughts, even if they're in opposition to mine. So Matthew 17, when they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. These other two don't mention the argument, by the way. They just don't. When they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. Lord, have mercy on my son, he said. He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him. You unbelieving and perverse generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy here to me. Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of the boy, and he was healed at that moment. Then his disciples came to Jesus in private and asked, why couldn't we drive it out? And he replied, because you have so little faith. But listen to this statement, because you have so little faith. Truly, I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. What's weird about that statement is, first he says you don't have enough faith, but then he says you only have to have faith the size of a mustard seed, which is the tiniest seed that they could even imagine. It's the tiniest thing, really. It's like a grain. It's like not even the size of a grain of rice. And he says you have so little faith, but then he says you don't even have faith the size of a mustard seed. And I think it's because what he's saying is, it's not your level of conviction. It's not your level of willpower. It's not your level of willing yourself to believe. It's that your faith in Jesus is so small. Right at this moment, your faith in yourself is pretty large. Your faith in your power is pretty big, but your faith in what God can do, your trusting in God, is so tiny. It's not even the size of a mustard seed. Not because it's a matter of certainty, but because it's a matter of, who are you trusting in? What are you trusting in? And at this moment, you're not trusting me at all. You're not looking to me to save you. You're not, you know, when I say that I'm going to die, you don't trust me. When I say that I understand what needs to happen to save the world, you don't trust me. When I tell you what glory is, you don't trust me. You're looking for your own glory. You're looking for your own power. And because of that, your faith isn't even as big as a mustard seed, because it's in the wrong place. It's not focused on God. The truth is, your faith can be super small if the faith that you have is in God that's so big. That's what it's about. It's about what God can do, not about your own sort of certainty. Luke 9:37 says this: the next day when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in the crowd called out, teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child. A spirit seizes him and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not. "You unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the impure spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at what? At the greatness of God. Again, that ties in with what I've been saying, that the disciples were kind of about the greatness of themselves at that moment. They were looking to kind of glorify themselves with their power. But when Jesus did it, people are amazed at the greatness of God. Faith which reveals the greatness of God is the faith that Jesus is looking for in this story. The man who says, "Help me in my unbelief," reveals the greatness of God, that God is able to do what he does, even with the man struggling with that. There's a commentator who says, you know, regardless of how the story reads, and some of it is a little weird, he just points this out. He says, bottom line is, Jesus found disputing scribes, a distracted father, a demon-possessed boy, and defeated disciples. And he silenced the scribe, comforted the father, healed the boy, and instructed the disciples. So whatever else is going on here, we at least see that Jesus is actually taking care of everything that's happening in the way that he needs to. It's just all a little bit kind of mysterious to us. But for me personally, in the context of stories we're about to read and the story we just read about the Transfiguration, I do think part of it is that the disciples are in this moment where they're wrestling with glory and power versus defeat and surrender, and they're wrestling with it. And this attempt to cast out the demon is part of that struggle, that they were doing it out of their own glory and their own power and not really seeing the greatness of God in the potential. So that's where I come down on it. We'll read the other stories, and they may or may not convince you that that's the context of all this. But regardless, anybody else have any thoughts on this? It is a peculiar story, so I think all thoughts are welcome.
I think that makes like a lot of sense. And I was kind of thinking too, like when it talks about them going out originally, like it talks about them like having like God giving them the authority to like cast out demons and do these things. And then like maybe now they're just kind of like, oh yeah, we could do that, and forgetting the, you know, God gave us the authority, you know, and like going back to that. Well, and it'd be kind of weird to, you know, like, so in some ways they're like trusting God. Well, maybe trusting God, but they are think that they have this power to cast out demons, but then they're not trusting God when he says, "I must die and rise again." So, you know, there's like a little bit of a conflict there. And I was also thinking, I don't know, I think that the boy's father, it seems like he does actually have a lot of faith. Because I mean, first of all, he went to like, he was looking for Jesus. And then he like was, I mean, I guess I don't know what happened with the disciples. Maybe they were just like, "We can do it." And he's like, "Okay, take your best shot." But anyway, you know, and then he kept going, you know, and telling Jesus and asking him, you know, even like through all of this.
No, I agree. I think, in fact, that's part of the point that Jesus is trying to drive home, is that this man has the kind of faith Jesus is looking for, that at that moment, the apostles,
yeah,
you know, because he's not confident in his own certainty, convictions, ability, faith. He's not confident in any of that. He's just asking Jesus for help. He's just depending on Jesus to do it. And and I think that is part of the point that Jesus is trying to make. So I agree with you. I think he actually turns out to be maybe the most faithful of anybody in the crowd at that moment. You know, I think that is kind of what we see there. As you were talking, I was also just thinking even about the irony of Peter, James, John, and Jesus are up on the mountain, and Jesus is being revealed in this incredible, glorious manner. And down below, you have the apostles desperately trying to show how glorious and powerful they are and failing miserably. There is an interesting contrast about the timing of those things happening, you know, at the same time. Any other thoughts?
Could it be the disciples were given that power to heal by Jesus when he sent them out, but they don't have as much power in his presence?
I mean, it could be. Sure. You know, again, he doesn't say specifically that to them, like you don't, you know, but
yeah.
But in a sense, the message is the same, because, you know, the message is you need me, you know, whether it's when they're in his presence, mm-hmm. they need him. So that's what they should be relying on anyway. Or when he sends them out, they're operating under his authority. So they need him. I think when he says it needs prayer. And in some translations, it says prayer and fasting. I think that the point's the same. Prayer and fasting was not a way of manipulating God ever in the scripture. Sometimes it's become that way in evangelicalism, but that's never what it was. It was never, we're going to fast and get God's attention. it was always, fasting was always a sign of dependence and submission and vulnerability. It was a way of saying, we're not, you know, we don't need food as much as we need you, you know? And so I think that is, even that, if it does say that, it's not in the most current translations, but if it does say prayer and fasting, that just emphasizes that idea of dependence, not that idea of manipulation of God, for God, what you want, but this idea of, you know, it's about me, it's about my authority, not yours. If you act, you're acting under my authority. If you don't act under my authority, that's not faith at all. That's just you doing what you want to do. And then trying to, you know, at the same time, claim that you have a special place with me, kind of thing. So.
Well, it makes sense that they would kind of need to learn that. I mean, cause like first, like Jesus was doing like everything, and then he gave them the power to, like, you know, to do that. And like through him. And so then they think, okay, we can do this, like just like Jesus did. And so it makes sense that they would have to like learn more that, oh, well, we can do it like through like God. And then, I mean, eventually like the Holy Spirit and stuff, but it would make sense that they would kind of not really quite get that yet.
Yeah. And as we move on through the other stories to come, you'll see they're still wrestling with that. And I think it is very much tied into the idea that he keeps bringing up dying. And they keep wanting to say, that is not a glorious, powerful victory. That's terrible. And I think it's all tied into this, just this idea of glory and power that they have is such odds with his plan. And it's coming out also in these ways that show that they want to glorify themselves, which is part of the reason they don't like his plan. Because if he's going to suffer and die, what does that mean to them? In fact, he told them straight out, yeah, you're going to suffer too. And they're not, that's not what they want right now. That doesn't make any sense to them. That's not why they joined him, to suffer, you know, and even though.
Yeah. Well, and glory and power being like through humility really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, no. And I think he is. I think that's right.
Independence.
I think he's taking the Sermon on the Mount, and he's now walking them through what that might actually look like for them. And they're really struggling with that. I think they're really wrestling with that. Well, let's go on. The very next thing that happens in all three Gospels is Jesus continues to talk about dying. Again, he goes right back to it. So here we have Mark 9, 30 through 32. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. So now he's like trying to stay out of the crowds because he's really focused on teaching his disciples. And what is he teaching them? He said to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. This is classic. I think we actually do this a lot too, where we think scripture is hard to understand, but sometimes we just don't like it. Sometimes it's not hard to understand. It just says something we're just not liking. And I think that's what's happening with him. He's speaking about as clearly as he's ever spoken. But yes, number one, rising again, that's a lot to ask someone to believe. I got you there. But even the dying, you know, they're just like, that can't be what he means, but they don't want to ask him. And the only reason they don't want to ask him is because they know what he's going to say. The same thing. He's just going to say it again. And they don't want to hear him say it again. He keeps saying it. Matthew 17, 22 through 23. When they came together in Galilee, he said to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him. And on the third day, he will be raised to life. And the disciples were filled with grief. I also like this idea that one gospel writer can say they didn't understand it. And the other one can say they were filled with grief. And that shows that you can in a sense get it, but and be sad about it and still not get it. You're like, why would he have to die? I don't understand that. But boy, this is really hurting us that he keeps saying this. Luke 9, while everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. But they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them, so they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. So it is interesting that in all three of those, and Luke emphasizes this particularly, it isn't just that he's going to die, it's that he's going to be delivered into the hands of men, that just men are going to be able to kill him. I think that's part of the point, that he's going to deliver himself into the hands of just men that he's been doing miracles for and healing and has complete power and authority over. You know, he's going to be delivered into their hands. And the apostles are just like, why would you do that? That's not even glorious. That's not even a good way to die. You know, why would you deliver yourself into the hands of men? This doesn't make any sense to us at all. But he keeps hammering it home, and he's getting really urgent about it. He's like, I know everyone else is talking about how amazing I am. I really need you to listen to me. I need you to hear this. This is what's going to happen. After Jesus and his disciples, so now we go on to Matthew 17. After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2-drachma temple tax came to Peter and said, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" "Yes, he does," he replied. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. "What do you think, Simon?" he asked. "From whom do the kings of earth collect duty and taxes? From their own children or from others?" "From others," Peter answered. "Then the children are exempt," Jesus said to him. "But so that we may not cause offense, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours." So this story doesn't fit the flow as well as the other stories do. He's going to go, because we're going to go right back to this glory versus, glory and power versus humility and submission in a second. But then we have this story in the middle. And it may not, maybe it doesn't fit the flow, but I did have this thought. It's an interesting story in a lot of ways. I think the collectors of the tax are basically accusing Peter and Jesus of not paying taxes. Peter says that Jesus does. I get the impression that Jesus has not, because he's about to. And he's actually saying to Peter, "I don't have to," right? That's the point of his story. He says, "Do people collect from their own children?" No. He says, "Well, God is the king of the temple. Why would he collect from me? The children are exempt." So first Jesus says, "I don't have to pay the tax." Then Jesus says, "But you know what? It also is no big deal to pay the tax, because I can grab my tax from a fish. You know, I can just make the tax appear in the first fish you catch." So Jesus is showing his authority in two ways. One, by saying, "I don't have to pay the temple tax because the temple's my house." And the second way he's saying it is, I have the authority, the temple tax, no big deal. I can get all the money I want from anywhere I want. I can do this crazy magic trick, because that's what this is. This is clearly just a trick to impress Peter, so that Peter will understand the authority, because this is a long drawn out trick. Peter goes out, catches a fish. What's the odds it's actually going to have a 4-drachma coin inside it? And it does. You know, it doesn't exactly fit the flow, except it does still match this point of authority. Jesus has authority. But even here, instead of standing on that authority and saying, "I don't have to do what you want me to do," he uses his authority instead to remain humble and under the radar, to go ahead and pay the tax, to do what they want him to do, so that no one sees offense. Why should he be worried about someone being offended? I don't know. He just apparently is at this point. So I don't know. There's a lot more to this story than that, that the placement, again, doesn't flow with a lot of the narrative we're seeing. And this is the only gospel that tells this story. So there may just be something that I'm missing that Matthew is seeing. Anybody have any comments on that story?
Well, if you take Peter back to having not enough faith or not relying on God, trying to rely on himself, it's a good time to reiterate, yeah, watch this long drawn out miracle for you, Peter.
That's really good, Pam. As you say that, I'm just noticing too that it does say it was for his tax and Peter's tax. So he's even providing for Peter at this moment too. That's really interesting.
That's because Peter lied to the temple tax collector.
I think he might have. I'm not sure, but it does appear to me he might have lied to him. Yeah. And Jesus is like, "You didn't have to lie. You didn't have to lie." Yeah, I think you're right about that. That's good, Pam. That's a good point. I like that. Any other thoughts? All right. So now this next story is going to fit exactly in with what we've been talking about. This is kind of the point. They're arguing about who's greatest, right? They're still kind of in that whole glory mode. And so here's what happens. Mark 9, 33 through 37. They came to Capernaum. Now, Capernaum is kind of their base of operations. So in some ways, they could just be returning for a rest. This could be a downtime, right? It says that he's teaching them. He's telling them he's going to die. He is trying to get away from the crowd. So this is kind of a downtime. And I think that's kind of a way to see it. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, right? The house he stays at might be Mary and Martha's. I think there's indication that he might be staying with someone, or it might be a house he's renting. It's not clear, but this is the house he comes back to a lot. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" Now, again, this is one of those moments where I think, even in his humanity, I think Jesus knows exactly what they were arguing about. I think this is one of those moments where he's asking them so that they'll answer, not because he doesn't know. "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. So this shows they're ashamed of their argument. They know their argument is not right. They know that Jesus is not going to be thrilled with the fact that they're arguing about who's greatest. They do have that much sense. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. Does this not fit very well with everything he's been telling them about? I'm going to suffer. I'm going to die. I'm going to deliver myself into the hands of men. I'm going to pay the temple tax when I don't have to. He's showing them, look, you think being the greatest of all is being on top of a mountain and having Moses and Elijah visit you. And yeah, that's pretty awesome. But honestly, for you guys, I want you to understand being the greatest of all is being willing to serve everyone. And my glory, the thing that is going to change the world is not that I met with Moses and Elijah on the mountaintop. What's going to change the world is that I'm going to die. And so I think he's trying to turn over their conception of power and glory and greatness. And so he says, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. And he took a little child whom he placed among them. Now, this makes it clear that although he calls the 12 to him, he's still surrounded by lots of disciples. I don't think he ran out and kidnapped a child. I think there are children around him. And we're reminded, as we're only reminded a couple of times, that this was probably pretty frequent. Jesus was the kind of person that children were comfortable with. And so they're hanging out with him too. And families are following him, right? Some of the disciples are families. And so they're following him. So there are children. I think a lot of times there are children around him. And so he takes a child. It just happens to be there, placed among him. And taking the child in his arms, which is a great picture. I just love that. He just kind of holds this kid. He said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me. So there's two points he's making here. One is you're all worrying about who's the greatest. And guess what? This child's the greatest. Not because he's smarter than you are. That's an incorrect way to read it. Not because he's more innocent than you are. That's also an incorrect way to read it. But because he's more dependent than you are. The greatest is the one who's most dependent. That fits the whole thing about this requires prayer. This requires faith. This requires dependence. This child, think about children. Children are vulnerable and dependent on you. And at a certain age, they believe whatever you tell them because they don't have a lot of other choice and they need to trust you. And if you lie to them, you can really mess them up because they are dependent upon you. And I think that's what he's saying. You guys are arguing about who's greatest because of this power you do, because you can cast out demons, because you know, maybe Peter, James, and John aren't saying exactly why, but right now they're feeling kind of special because they were up on that mountain and maybe they're kind of getting into it. And he's like, none of that. What makes you greatest is you know, look at this child. He's completely dependent. He's completely trusting me. I picked him up and held him in my arms. He's not fighting me. He is being supported and held by me. And that is how you should see yourselves. And if you welcome this child, you welcome me. And then to take it a step further, he says, and even me, in my role in this earth, as he explains in other places, I am submitting to the Father. I also am in a role of submission and humility. And if I can be in that role, then you can definitely be in that role. Matthew 18, the same story. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? He called a little child to him and placed a child among them. And he said, truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, does he mean dumb? Does he mean, you know, what, younger? No, he means dependent. He means that kind of dependent faith and vulnerability that children have, that trust that they give really pretty easily if they're young enough and haven't been totally spoiled by adults in their lives or ruined by adults in their lives. They give faith and trust pretty easily. And that's what he's saying. You have to change. You have to go back to being dependent. You're all worried about your power. You're all worried about your greatness. You're all worried about showing off by exercising demons and other things. You need to change and become like little children. And he says, if you don't do that, you won't enter the kingdom of heaven. I think if you're worried about the theology of that, I think you can just connect it back to the fact that salvation itself requires that dependence. To be able to say to Jesus, I can't get myself there. I need you to hold me. I need you to carry me there. I think that's what the kind of strict theological reference there is. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. He goes on to say this, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. I think the point there is, because children are so trusting, because children are so dependent, then that's really bad. That is in the world of morality, that is one of the most immoral things you can do, is to exploit the vulnerability of that child, the trust of that child, and lead them to bad places because of that. That is something your heavenly Father looks very sternly upon. Luke 9, an argument started among disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. And then he said to them, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for it is the one who is least among you all who is the greatest. Anybody else have any comments or thoughts on that story?
No, thanks. That ties it in better.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does seem like there is.
Yeah, no, this has been kind of, I get like the humility, like I thought the humility thing before, but yeah, no, with everything else and what, yeah, you were saying, it makes it, I feel like, a lot clearer and not as random.
That's good. Yeah. And I don't think in general, the gospel writers are, and I know you know this, it's just a good reminder for us. I think in general, the gospel writers are, they're writing flows, they're writing a narrative, and they're piecing together the narrative and leaving stuff out and maybe occasionally compressing things because of the points they want to make. And it does seem like this flow in all three of these gospels is pretty clear. You know, where does humility fit in all this? Where does suffering fit in all of this? Where does power and glory fit in all of this? Those aren't at odds with each other. Those actually come together sometimes. And that the apostles are struggling with that. And in fact, the very next story, apostles are still struggling with it. It's like a back and forth in each of these stories. Mark 9, 38 through 41 says this, teacher, said John, we saw someone driving out demons in your name and we told him to stop because he was not one of us. Now, this is interesting. John doesn't say he was a bad person or he didn't have the right motivations or that he was unsuccessful. He just says he wasn't one of us. So I told him to stop. And Jesus says, don't stop him. If he's doing good things, he's driving demons out and he's even doing it in my name, which again, the phrase in my name is not just a slang. It means in your authority. John is saying he was driving out demons by your authority and we told him to stop, which is ironic because if it's by Jesus' authority, what authority does John have to tell him to stop? But he says, don't stop him, Jesus said, for no one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us is for us. He says, look, stop gatekeeping so hard. You know, they may not be officially in our little circle, but it sounds to me like he's on our side is what Jesus is saying, which is a pretty generous of spirit position to be in. He's just like that. It sounds like he's on our side. Why are you trying to stop him? It's not about credit. It doesn't matter. You know, somebody once said, it's amazing. You know, the world has yet to see what could happen by someone who doesn't care who gets the credit, you know, and I think this is, Jesus is like, just, you're gatekeeping so hard right now. And the fact is, if he's not against us, he's for us. It sounds to me like he's on our side. Relax. But what does it matter if he's not in our circle? He's not robbing from you. But I think the point is that John was feeling a little bit, and the others were feeling a little bit like it was taking away from their glory. Look, if he's doing it, then we're not special in that sense. Truly, I tell you, anyone who gives a cup of water in my name because you belong to the Messiah will certainly not lose their reward. He says, look, anyone who's not against you, anyone who helps you, even if they just give you a cup of water, I'm going to honor them. So instead of gatekeeping, see this differently. See this as the fact that we have a lot of people in our corner. We have people on our side. Luke says the same thing. Master, said John, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he is not one of us. Do not stop him, Jesus said, for whoever is not against you is for you. I think that's it's interesting. Jesus at one point says, if you're not for me, you're against me. And here he says, if you're not against me, you're for me. It's interesting. It can go both ways. I think people like to quote the first one more because we like to draw lines and we like to gatekeep. But to think about the idea that there might be people on our side who don't get it all. There might be people on our side who aren't exactly where we are. They're not in our circle. They're not in our community. But goodness, if they're not against us, you know, maybe we can be on the same side. Maybe they are for us. Maybe we can react a little differently about protecting our territory and be gatekeep a little bit less hard. So there you have it. This series of stories, it's all the back and forth. It's about suffering. It's about humility. That is glory and power. And the apostles wrestling with, but we thought glory and power was going to be, you know, make us look important. We thought it was going to make us look like the big team. We're close to you. We should be the ones casting out demons. We should be the ones showing off. The scribes argue with us and pick on us when we don't do it well. Now you're telling us that even if someone else does it, that's okay as long as you're getting the credit. You know, there really is this back and forth tension about glory, about wanting to glorify themselves. And I think part of the message is they are worried about Jesus saying he wants to die, but there is that selfish component to it that makes them wonder about where they sit. You know, if he's going to die, are we on the wrong side? Are we also going to die? You know, what does this really look like? We thought this was going to be mountaintops, and it's a whole lot of just down on the earth. And so that's kind of the wrestling. So that's all I've got for tonight. Anybody have any last comments, questions, anything else you want to throw in here before we call it for the evening?
Well, I like to, like Pam brought up a little bit too, like, they're really struggling with this, and it's like mind blowing, and it's not really connecting them. But then Jesus is still giving them, like, he's still showing them, like, power. Like, he's not throwing it all out. He's still like, yeah, I'm still the guy, you know, I just wanted to change this idea some and see, yeah, I got this taken care of, and I am God. And yeah.
No, that's absolutely right. And it's important to do that, because he doesn't want to say to them, you were mistaken about me altogether. He wants to say, no, you're right. I am the Messiah. I am powerful. I am the Son of God. I am approved. I am all these things. But you need to understand that that is also the person who's going to die. You need to understand
that. That's also like showing power, even though it doesn't
seem
like it.
That's right. You need to see it's not only the same guy, it's the same power. Right. Yeah, you're right. So I think that's really good. Anybody else have any thoughts?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Back when we started studying the New Testament, you went over the different focuses of each of the gospel writers.
Yep.
All these are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. What was John's focus that he's not focusing on these stories?
Yeah, so John's focus was more philosophical. So John writes much later than the other Gospels. So as I mentioned, he actually already knows. He's read, he knows Matthew, Mark, Luke's Gospels. He knows what other people have seen. There's reason to believe he probably wasn't even going to write a Gospel. He probably didn't feel like he needed to. But ultimately what he does is he writes a Gospel, and he writes it in a way which the Greeks can understand as well as the Jews. And he tends to be writing it to show them that what they both want is the same thing. The Greeks are looking for what he calls, what Socrates called logos. That's the word John uses. The Greeks are looking for logos, which is the answer to, it's like the underlying truth that makes the whole world work. And the Jews are looking for a Messiah. And what John ends up doing is saying, guess what? The Jewish Messiah and the Greek logos are actually the same person, because God is the thing that makes the universe work. And so that's his distinct flavor, is that he's really writing a sort of he's a much more philosophical approach, because he's writing people who think philosophically. And so a lot of he doesn't tell a lot of the stories. He has Jesus make a lot of statements. We will get into more John here in a little bit as we kind of catch up to where he is. But a lot of these stories in the middle of Jesus doing stuff, it's just not as interesting to John. And again, it's already been told. So
he's the nitty gritty.
And Susan, with John having 40 years of preaching experience now underneath his belt, he knew what worked for each of these groups, what they understood, and how to make them understand it.
Yeah, that's really good. That's a really good point too. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys for coming. Lord willing, the creek don't rise. We'll meet again next week.
Thank you for joining us. The Journey is a ministry of Discipleship Matters, which is an extension of Focus Church and is created by David McGill for the purpose of helping equip pastors to build discipleship communities in their own churches. If you'd like to learn more about the books and conferences and coaching offered by David, you can check out his website, davidmcgill.com.